hope that people are able to find us and seize those opportunities to engage, because ultimately it's the voices of individuals reaching out to their lawmakers that makes the biggest difference.
That was my conversation with Liz Komar, Sentencing Reform Counsel at the Sentencing Project. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Many thanks to my guest, Liz Komar, and to the Sentencing Project. And thanks especially to you, dear listener. You make it all worth it. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Welcome to another special programming here at KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, and we have very special guests. And please introduce yourselves and tell us everything about this project.
My name is Mike Crenshaw, and I am a co-producer of the podcast, a co-narrator of the podcast, and now a co-editor and author of the book.
And I'm Selena Flores. I am one of the producers and co-narrators with Mike of the podcast, and one of the editors of the book.
My name is Mo Bastern. I was one of the writers on the podcast and also the principal writer for the book.
My name is Jonathan Mazzocchi, and I was one of the folks featured in the book that focuses on the 1980s and 1990s fight against fascists, white supremacists in the Portland area.
So one of the ideas we had at the beginning of our gathering here today was to maybe, since there are four of us, have Selena interview Jonathan Mazzocchi, and then I interview Mo Bastern, and then we trade places, and that will get us through the conversation.
Sounds like a plan.
Right on.
Jonathan.
Selena.
So I want to think of it in terms of someone coming in from outside who might not know about the podcast or the book. So would you be willing to talk about kind of your role in the Coalition for Human Dignity, which we talk about in those projects?
Sure. I was one of the founders of the Coalition for Human Dignity. In 1988, it was founded shortly after the racist murder of Mulla Gavassara at the hands of racist boneheads affiliated with a group called East Side White Pride. And together with a group of folks, activists and community people, a pretty diverse range of folks, we started attending community meetings and knew that there was a rising threat of vigilante racist violence targeting people of color communities, targeting Jews, targeting the LGBTQ plus community and whatnot. So we also recognized early on that the state, the police, social services, politicians and so on didn't understand the unique nature of the threat and didn't have much to offer in terms of countering it. So from the earliest days in 1989, and even prior to the murder of Mulla Gavassara, there were a group of us who were focused pretty narrowly on this kind of threat. So my particular bailiwick, if you will, was on research and intelligence on these groups, how they posed particular threats, How large was their membership? How political were they? What kind of attacks could we expect? How could we counter them? So I did that work into the late 1990s. And I'm in my late 50s now. When I started, I was 22. And I took a hiatus, a sabbatical, if you will, in the early 2000s. But during this maybe roughly 15-year period, my work was centered on the research and the intelligence to counter these folks.
Awesome. Thank you. And how did you become involved in the podcast project?
Some of the folks, Mo Baustern, Mike Crenshaw, you, and Aaron Yankee and others had reached out to me to provide some, firsthand reports of what we were doing at that time. And nobody had assembled any kind of history around the Coalition for Human Dignity, which was the main organization I was working with, much less anti-racist action or skinheads against racial prejudice. And those were the three main organizations, around which the book is built. So immediately it was really special for me, because I'd been out of the city for a couple decades, not really rooted here. I was rooted elsewhere. And so I was, the book provided an opportunity for me to reconnect with folks who did this work, and many who have continued to do this work during that time. And suffice it to say that that thread continues and is qualitatively and quantitatively much worse today than it was back then, I would argue, despite all of the progress we've made in different areas of social and economic life. Regardless, that threat is real. It continues to exist, and it requires the same questions of us. What's the nature of the threat? How do we counter it? And the book has been a remarkable intervention on those questions, I think.
Thank you for that. I can pass it on.
Okay. Sure. This is Mark again, and I wanted to ask Mo some questions. Mo, first of all, thank you for being a principal writer on the project, because a lot of what people got to hear when the narration was happening were things that you wrote for us to read. What was it like for you crafting literature around this story?
Mike, what a great question. Thank you so much for that. It was really challenging. I've mainly been a writer of my own experiences. And so to try and take in the experiences of other people and remove myself was a awesome opportunity to learn that as a skill. And then I do have and did have emotional attachment and experiential attachment to the subject in my own life. I had run with similar folks back in Chicago in the early 90s, and it was gratifying to be able to provide a container for these important stories to be put out in the world. And it was also cool to write stuff down and then hear you guys say it.
Mm-hmm.
Hear you and Selena say it. And it was really fun. I ended up having a writing partner for the podcast with in Alec Dunn, who also did the graphic design on the book. And I tried by myself to write the for a couple of months to write the narration alone, and it was just too much for me. And I think part of it was the responsibility of trying to tell the story of a place where I didn't experience these things, and really personal stories and really intense things. You know, I just wanted to be able to respect everyone's stories. So then when Alec got on board, Alec grew up in Portland. Alec was present for some of the uprisings and riots during the Bush years. He was here for all of that. He has a different relationship to the story. And so we tied it together. And then also when we would read various interviews, like we organized, Aaron did a huge piece in editing. And editing is an often unsung and overlooked aspect of writing. And so having an experienced master editor like Aaron Yankee, who took all of the interviews and organized them into, chunks or chapters or episodes, they were episodes in the podcast, they became chapters in the book. It became, we could put the interviews together. And so then Icky and I had a list of ongoing things that we were tying to the uprising that was happening on the street. So we were like, well, how can we get prison abolition in? Oh, okay, here's Jonathan talking about, where this racist gang formulated in a prison. That's an argument. That's a way to talk about how stupid it is to keep incarcerating people. Great. And so we were able to, it was a little bit of, it was a lot like that, weaving. It was a lot of a weaving. And then there was a really cool thing that I think would probably be dramatized in a TV show. Like, we were, it was the pandemic, and we would have these five-hour meetings. and we would be arguing, and I would be like, blah, blah, blah. But we have to see, Mizaki was out there and Selena and la la la, and Icky would just be like, write that down. and I would be trying to remember what I had just said. And I was like, is this what I said? So, it was a small drama. Meanwhile, cats are walking on keyboards and,
So will this be a forthcoming docudrama?
Well, we already have the podcast.
Right.
Then we have the book and the live events.
Right.
So, yeah.
Draw the line at reality TV. Just draw it.
Well, there's a writer's strike, so unscripted shows are going to take off again,
And then we could just, that's a way we could be like, I know you guys don't want to protest anymore, but if you get out in the street, we'll be out there writing about it.
Some of what you talk about reminded me of the issue of representation.
Yeah.
And you've been helping us with some logistical and administrative work, booking events. Like, for instance, we have a book event coming up June 6th at Powell's Bookstore. And we were doing an event recently. It was online. It was the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair. And there was a comment, and it was, how come, because it was Jonathan Mizaki, myself, and John Baer. Who else was on that panel? Alec Dunn was moderating. And the question came from the audience, well, how come there are no women on this panel? And I think something that people might not realize is that over half of our team is women. But can you talk about the issue of representation and maybe some of the care that was put into the podcast and the book and making sure that it wasn't this male-dominated space?
Yeah, sure. I can take a stab at it. And I do want to just say, my brain needs me to say that the question was, why is the panel all men?
Right.
Which is a slightly different but sometimes, important thing. And I also want to say, I talked to a few people about that question, and I talked with somebody who's recently started working for the Western States Confronting White Nationalism in the Schools curriculum program. And he said that he really hears that question as a bid for inclusion. And it's from the outside. And I see it, I took it really personally, and I heard it as I can't believe we worked so hard to put this panel together, and you can't see all the women behind it that are doing all this work. And I think the question is, first of all, do I belong? And I just want to say, yes, you do.
Thank you.
I am a queer, white, cis woman who has been through cancer, and I have no breasts, and so I just present in a really interesting way in the world. We have lots of experience on the panel, in the book and in the podcast and in the greater group. Like, we have hundreds of years of experience in all different bodies. And we try to uplift everyone's voice and make room for everyone and to say, you know, you do belong.
Right.
We are standing with you against fascism. And there is a way in which we have forgotten our manners, and we have forgotten, like, we've been all so wounded and isolated. I think that it's easy to look at a thing and say, oh my God, that's cool, I'm attracted to it, and I'm just gonna like reject myself before anyone can reject me. And so I just really want to open my arms through this project to anyone who wants to be part of it and stand with us against fascism. And then as far as the project goes, we worked hard to, like, in a podcast, we learned you really want to have a lot of different voices, and it's a scripted podcast. It's not a podcast of people talking and like this event, like this conversation today. So we worked hard to write the script in ways so that it's like, oh, we can bring in an older voice here. What is Abby Layton saying about this kind of thing? Because she is she was older than everybody at the time, and her voice is different. And then we can have a young, vibrant voice, and what is this person saying, and what is that person saying? And so we really strove to make sure that the voices were different for representation, and also just to be able to listen to things easier, so it wasn't one voice droning on and on. And also, people bring different energy, and it comes through your voice regardless of the words you're saying. And I believe that you're bringing through that quality, and that is part of what, and when you really bring that through, you can feel it in the project. And part of, like, this project being well received, I think, comes from that.
That's a really inspiring dynamic answer to that question. No, I really appreciate it, because it wasn't a scripted question. You didn't plan the answer to it. So I feel like there's a real authentic presence when you're answering the question, because you're speaking in a way that I think people should be inspired and encouraged to understand, as I was listening. Because something that came to mind was, this is an opportunity for people who feel inspired and motivated to play a part, mm-hmm. in what they're reflecting on. And the fact that the podcast and the book is a tool for that, I think, is good. Yeah.
And I'm an upcoming reality show on the Oprah Channel.
Exactly.
I really love the reframing of that. Like, getting to the root of it, asking, do I belong? That's
yeah.
so important.
Yeah.
And I think for us, like, right now, just the level of horizontal oppression that is just really knee-jerk response in anarchist spaces and in leftist spaces, I just think we should talk about it.
Right.
And if we know that what people are asking is, do I belong, then it insulates my heart for when that question comes at me, when I'm vulnerable and up there. I mean, I just kind of wanted to be like, do you have any idea how many emails I sent? Have you ever organized with anarchists? Like, and they were lovely. The Montreal event, I would encourage everyone to keep an eye on our website, which is itdidhappenherepodcast.com, because there's a media page where you can keep up with all of the events we're doing online. And that Montreal Anarchist Book Fair event was awesome. It made me feel so much better in my heart just walking around. It was so good. You guys did such a great job.
Thank you, Mo.
Yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Jonathan, did you want to interview Selena?
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, so... I came into the project talking to a couple of you, with Aaron and with Mo, and then Selena, you interviewed me.
Yeah,
early on, and I think you interviewed some other folks.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious what how early did you join the project, and how did you? Well, here's one thing I was really curious about. How did you frame it in terms of how long a period you guys were deciding to sort of focus on?
Well, I think that decision was made before I arrived and or was based on actual events. And up in the, until the CHD, the coalition, disbanded, perhaps.
Yeah.
Which I think was 1997-ish.
Around there.
And so what was your first question? I'm sorry.
I guess just your initial involvement.
Oh, so I was volunteering here at KBOO, and I knew Aaron from KBOO. I knew Mike from KBOO, and Aaron actually put out a call for people to do an interview and just be on the team, and I applied for that and was accepted to do that. And then somebody else from KBOO who was a producer, going to be a producer, had to drop out, and they recommended me to step in. And so I did that, and I didn't quite understand the scope at the time. And I'm glad I didn't. I was just kind of like, yeah, let's do it. Just dove in head first. But I've learned so much. And so I helped with research in terms of who to interview. I got in contact with Abby Layton again through Facebook, and she kind of helped with connecting me to Scott Nakagawa and several other people. Yeah. And and then at some point we were ready to start assembling things, and if there became the question of who would narrate, and it kind of was just like, do you want to do it? And I was like, okay. And yeah, so I have to say this has all been a big learning experience, but I've enjoyed it, and I've met some really great people.
Having your first interview with me was pretty special, because up until that point, I'd really never been invited to reflect deeply and for some length of time on, you know, my own involvement in that work. And then to look and see what's changed since then. Immensely rewarding for me.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great to talk with you too. I was like, just could tell you have so much experience and are wise. Maybe you wouldn't say that about yourself, but
yeah,
I would say
probably
that.
Probably not.
Well, and you really turned out to be quite a... Aaron was, when we were working on the pandemic, I remember telling you this, like, because I think we talked for the first time, Jonathan and I talked for the first time in, right after the December 25th. And I had a little space in my schedule, and I was like stuck on trying to figure something out, and the John Bear episode was going to drop, and I was like, I can't figure out this answer. No one has this history. This history doesn't exist anywhere. And that is the thing that I learned, was like, this era of time exists in what I started calling a digital shadow or an internet shadow, because it was before, it was like, it hasn't really been digitized yet, and it was right before internet stuff. So nobody knows anything that was happening here. It's not really available. So all I had was the Oregonian, and Erin was very protective of her interviewees, and she really was conscious of the fact that we weren't able to pay people, and she really honored everybody's stories and their time. And Icky and I would be like, can we talk to this person? And she'd be like, And she just really was protective of us bugging people. And then I finally got a chance to talk to you, and we talked for like an hour and a half, and it was the best. And I got so much information. And that really opened a door for you to become a real resource for both the podcast and the book. I know Icky and I talked to you several more times. And I just like really appreciate the way that, despite your initial concerns about security, which I respect, and I just want to say that Jonathan definitely vetted both of us, like, and was careful about just not talking to us, and that is a piece. Like, I think if anybody else wants to do a project like that, just I want people to know how carefully Aaron approached people, and we all approached people, and we didn't have an expectation that we could have your stories just because we asked, you know. And and then just like you became almost like a unpaid researcher in our project at the end, even though all of us are a little bit in that. But yeah, so I just want to really thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. And your process, how you guys worked that out, was again remarkable. And there was a huge impact on me to be able to work with you folks to unearth a lot of these documents, pictures, videos, you know, personal testimonies that have been buried. And there's a little side story about the because my primary involvement in this was research and intelligence, we compiled a large number of filing cabinets full of information.
I was going to ask about this.
Yeah, and then they over the I stopped doing this work sort of full time around 2000, and the files are missing still. I'm kind of still a little upset about that, but again, that's a side thing. What's important is that a lot of that material in there it was lost because it hasn't been digitized, and a lot of Oregonian stories, even just mainstream press stuff, are not accessible. And interesting example I like to bring up is if you type up an inquiry, a Google search for David Irving, Portland, 1990, there's nothing there. And there was a big series of events. He was a Holocaust denier and a main organizer of neo-Nazi groups in the Pacific Northwest during this time. And all of those stories were just, I mean, they just didn't exist. They're not on the internet to this day, but you can find them in It Did Happen Here. Very important stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there is a Netflix documentary about that, about the book. Gosh, what was her name? There was a woman who took him to court got him to sit, because she published a book, and she took him to court. He's now he's a discredited British historian.
Yeah, really pulp fiction novelist.
Yeah, awful. But we were able, the one things I was able to find in the Oregonian about David Irving were columns by that
Phil Stanford,
yeah,
the
Phil
Oregonian
Stanford,
columnist.
Oregonian
yeah.
columns. And I just want to say his columns were over and over against, like, people would show up, anti-fascists would show up, demonstrate against David Irving coming to town to preach about how the Holocaust did not happen, and they would seek to shut down his events. And then Phil Stanford would inevitably write a column about how people were overreacting and they should just let him speak, and it's just
he's
free
just
speech.
A you know British historian.
Don't worry about it. And that is still happening. Still
it's
happening.
It's funny how the liberal media actually, like, for those of us who are pretty far left and radical and have an analysis, we find a lot of problems with how the liberal media attacks the left. You know, where if you were to listen to right-wing pundits, there would be this narrative that says that the liberal media is, you know, pro-Black Lives Matter and pro-Antifa and all this stuff, when in actuality, they often discredit and undermine the narrative when it comes to the work that has been going on, you know, to fight fascism, to fight racism, to take a stance against capitalism, patriarchy, and systems of oppression in this country. Yeah.
Another good example of that is J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio. His entire backstory and rise to fame went through Hollywood. It went through traditional liberal channels. And he is, well, he's a far-right protege of Peter Thiel.
So does he, I mean, this whole Hollywood thing?
Hillbilly Elegy, wasn't that his book?
Correct, yeah, Hillbilly Elegy. Okay. That means vicious far-right stuff. And it's there in the early, and there's a film about it. I think Ron Howard made it. This really reactionary stuff, which, you know, basically blames poor working class folks from Appalachia for their own circumstances. And
right.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, conditional. I can't believe I said that.
Mm. Well, okay. I think that there's
it's
a...
not live.
There's, yeah, a, there's a through line. Thank you to Indir. Thank you to whoever's going to edit this program.
Yeah, I am so sorry. And I'd be willing to put in volunteer time for having done that.
Wash the dishes. That, so.
Oh, my goodness.
Dumb button.
Yeah. Yeah, it, I don't know if you're going to...
We just had to pause, this has
caused a moment of reflection.
Oh, okay, I'm going to interview Michael Crenshaw. He's in the studio with us now. I noticed you are wearing, what is that shirt, a Baldi's
It's a Baldi's SLK Syndicate hoodie.
Well, yes. I love it, because while we were here, I was thinking about one of my favorite stories of the book is Jonathan driving China around, and China, like, pulling up to somebody in China, jumping out of the car and going, "Are you white pride?" And then slapping him, and then going up to someone, "Are you white pride?" And I just love thinking of Jonathan driving anyone around to just slap white nationalists. And so,
well, you know what was, you know, and I don't know what the... I don't want to get anybody in trouble here, but what I will say is that I didn't meet Jonathan back in the day that I recall. Did you recall meeting? Did we meet each other in the 80s when in the late night or late 80s in the early 90s?
May have been. I don't recall.
I don't think we did. Yeah, but
in the shop.
I heard a lot. There's urban folklore about the events, some of the events that Jonathan was present for. So it was sweet. Decades later, to actually meet this person who played a crucial role in some of the events that took place that made Portland a safer place for people to be, to exist. Yeah.
And so, Mike, I would say this book and this podcast are very much your story and the story of your young manhood and coming of age and coming into adulthood and decisions that you made at that time. And I am curious about what it's like for you to stand in your 50s and reach back to that time and to that young man and, like, synthesize that and, like, what kind of effect that has had on yourself as a parent and then also as just doing the work that you do in the world with your music and your education outreach stuff that you do and your work overseas and, like, how you bring that everywhere you go.
Thank you, Mo. That's an important question for me to reflect on and speak to. So I never imagined when I was 16, 17, 18, that the work we were doing, which didn't feel like work, it just felt like we were being friends and doing what was right. I never imagined that later in life, many decades later, it would be recognized as something that has impact, as it has become apparent, right? With the podcast and the book, the response is incredible. It's created an opportunity for me to consider that this thing that I so personally and subjectively identify with has always been a lot bigger than me and my life experience and my story. And I feel really honored, blessed, and fortunate to have the gift of something that moved me on such deep levels that is central to who I am, to come back around and provide a platform for me to engage in social change and the work of social justice activism, in media creation, in public engagement, in ways that are far deeper than I could have achieved then, right? And it also, you know, having been an artist for 30 years, there's this very self-centered thing about trying to promote your brand as an artist, as a hip-hop artist specifically, that's trying to influence an audience of strangers to finance your career so you can become popular enough to just do art, right? There's something very self-centered about that, to the point where sometimes it can actually be toxic and narcissistic in a certain way because of what we have to do to survive in capitalism, right? And so to be able to have an impact that isn't just about me, that is evidence of collaboration with peers, with colleagues, with comrades, with friends, with chosen family, It's really remarkable because it takes me out of this kind of competitive rat race of trying to convince somebody that what I'm doing is worth their attention. Because the combined effort of the collective, whether it was from people who were present and part of this movement decades ago, or whether it's from those of us working together now to bring to light the stories that are in the book and part of the podcast, is exactly the type of work that I want to be involved in. You know, many hands do make light work. And I'm continuing to find that the reach is not just something that's impressive for those of us who participated in creating this thing, but it's something that just continues to grow. And people tell us, you know, the validation, if there was ever validation, it's the fact that people reach out and say, hey, their personal testimony, this book has really made me reflect on where I was at. It's also really important for people who are part of what's happening now. So all those things are part of what I get to feel and think about. It's great.
Thank you, Mike. I have some follow-up questions. And also, I do want to say what we had. I mean, that just reminds me, when we walked in the station, we had Phil come up to us and say, you guys got me through the pandemic.
Right.
And his partner was a street medic during the uprising. And so, and said that, she said the same thing. So, you don't know who you're going to touch when right. you do this work. And so I would just say to anyone who's listening, like, do your work and lift it up. And, like, for example, my family has not listened to the podcast because they didn't want to be depressed. And so, like, in some way, there's part of me that's just like, that's the only people I want to listen to, you know? But at the same time, I know that these words will get to people when they need to hear them.
That's right.
And there's a question in that, which is, if you reach back, so a thing that I'm concerned about and that I noticed in doing all this research and writing for the book, across the board, the young people who were frequently physically engaging with the white supremacists and with the racist kids were also very young. And there's a way in which I, as an older person, when I walk around, know that I look like someone's mom. And then I get projected, like, you find out a lot about people's mommy issues when you start looking like a mom. Yeah. Even though I'm not a mom, and I want to be able to connect with these kids and just be like, no, you don't understand. Like, I am with you. And I really appreciate the book for being able to say, like, read this book and see who I am in a little bit of a way. But also, I just want to know, like, if you can reach back in time to yourself and have a clue about what is the best way for us to reach youth, and I know you work with young people in various capacities, like, what is it that, I don't know, like, I want to make that bridge.
So that's another great question, because again, it makes me remember what it was like to be 16, searching for purpose, searching for identity, responding to a need. And the need was, I don't want to feel a violent threat to my existence in my community. Mm-hmm. And I need to do something about it. And finding agency in that with my friends allowed me to enter into dangerous ways of behaving that were about survival, that were about self-defense and community defense together, mm-hmm. right? I didn't realize that when I was doing that, that was activism. Mm-hmm. But through doing that work in my development, I started to become curious about what role that work played on a historical continuum. And I started to be inspired by the stories of those that came before me, people in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, American Indian Movement, the Weather Underground, the Black Liberation Army, and all these movements that preceded the work that we were doing as teenagers. And at that point, it just so happened that there were adults in the community who are educators, who are activism, who are older members of a social justice movement and anti-oppression work, that started to notice the work we were doing on the streets and made an effort to reach out to some of us and to guide us. And two of the people that did that were two of my teachers at an alternative high school. They began to give me a political education by offering me an opportunity to be a paid teacher and learn how to create curriculum and develop an analysis through studying history. They put a couple of us who were baldies in study groups. So now we're not only politically active and involved in direct action and community defense, but we're reading about the history of the work that came before us that begins to develop our consciousness and let us know there are many ways to approach this work. This work has been going on, and now you are stepping into this work. So what we've been able to do with the podcast and the book is to create media. One of the questions in terms of young people who are engaged in direct action, which is dangerous work, it can be violent, people die, people get hurt, people go to prison for a very long time. That's in the book, it's in the podcast. We need to figure out ways to increase the effect and the impact of our work and decrease the amount of casualties we sustain, the amount of damage that we sustain. And one of the ways to do that is through media and through influencing people's consciousness, through art, through cultural products, through creation of information and dissemination of information that can help people begin to see the world that we live in a way that empowers us. Because everybody's not going to fight in the street.
No.
You know?
Thank you. And I'm wondering about, can I ask one more question?
Yes.
I'm wondering about young Mike and his comrades standing there with that teacher, except, you know, like, I'm hearing you say that they hired you. They gave you, they fulfilled your need to have agency.
That's right.
And so I'm hearing that a role that I could play as an older person is find a way to bring people in so that they have agency over their own work, but also there's a channel between us where I can flow media their way. And also they can flow their own skills and expertise my way. And I think part of it that I've experienced with as a young person in activism was always being shut down and always being told I didn't know anything. And it's like, well, yeah, I didn't know anything. What I'm hearing is, you know, we didn't know anything. We were just out there with our energy. So I just want to send that out there. Like,
shout out
to the wisdom of the young people.
Yeah. And shout out to people in our community who are doing the work of giving young people opportunities to engage in their passion and to also be paid as they develop their skills so that it becomes a path to career. And then they get to decide how they use that skill set, whether they want to do something that's radical in nature or whether they just want to sustain themselves economically. That's important. So I can think of Sister Imani Muhammad and youth. Y-O-U-T-H. I can think of Friends of Noise. I can think of Outside the Frame. There are a lot of people who do this kind of work. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In keeping with that, a shout out to anti-fascist organizations that are practically doing the difficult work on the ground. Rose City Antifa, the Pacific Northwest Anti-Fascist Workers Collective. There are anti-fascist groups in Corvallis and Eugene and elsewhere. And they are doing the difficult work of doxing, tracking these folks, and helping people organize in their communities against them. And it's interesting, a lot of that work has a character similar to what we focused on in the late 80s and early 90s, which were neo-Nazi groups in a relatively urban or suburban context, okay? But there are far-right racists organizing in more rural areas. For instance, the Bundy folks, Eamon Bundy. And I want to shout out to my comrades over at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, led by Leonard Zeskin. And they continue to do, you know, really critical work tracking these folks and helping communities organize against them in more rural settings. And that fight is one we have to take to them as well.
And if anybody rurally is listening and wants to get involved, you can locate the nearest chapter of the Rural Organizing Project in Oregon, which was started in resistance to the Oregon Citizens Alliance, who in the 90s were trying to deny civil rights to LGBTQ plus communities.
Mm. Yep.
I was just recalling the name Lon Mabon.
Oh, yeah.
I made up a rap.
Bob. Let's hear it.
Nope, we're not going to.
Okay, great. You
have a rap about Lon Mabon.
I do want to know, so one of the things that happens in groups that are very young, like comprised of young people, I find as a person that was involved in those groups, is when injury happens between people, there isn't frequently experience or skill or access to resources to help people navigate that injury, whether it's injury that happens when you're on the street and it happened, like you have to go to a hospital, obviously, or that someone hurts someone else. Because when we get to a point where violence is the tool we use against fascism, and then perhaps that's something that we use against each other as well.
Mm.
And that is a question that I have for us all. And I was really inspired by the talk when you guys were talking in the Montreal conversation about like violence being like continuing to talk about violence as an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just like how you saw healing or got healing or what avenues towards healing came to both of you or any of us when we have been harmed in violence in our communities. Or have been the actors of that violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I know that's kind of a heavy question, and we don't...
It's a good question, right? If I think it's responsible to consider these things. If we're going to talk about violence, then we have to talk about the implications, the impact, the consequences of violence that actually go on beyond the violent event itself, whether it's an offensive act of violence, whether it's political violence, interpersonal violence, abuse of some sort, it doesn't matter. It marks us in ways. And sometimes our consciousness doesn't have the discernment to go, well, that was good violence or that was bad violence. You see what I'm saying? And so the moral, ethical aspect of violence is more of an intellectual exercise than it is a fact. Right? Mm-hmm. Because when I'm engaged in political violence for community defense, the fact of the matter is the people who are getting hurt as a result of the violence aren't going to feel like, well, at least I got hurt on behalf of Mike's mission. And sometimes that causes people to go further into their position.
Right.
Right. And so now we're locked in this stalemate where there's this cycle of trauma that's repeating, sometimes in a transgenerational way, and it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important for us to recognize and be able to talk honestly about how violence affects us. It's important for us to have community, chosen family, biological family, maybe even institutional support for when we're hurt to be able to heal. Okay, it's important on the street to have people who are medics who aren't part of the institutional structure of society, right? And it's important for us at some point to have access in the will to understand that reconciliation is part of healing, right? And so what I mean is, never am I going to be apologizing for the evil of fascism, white supremacy, and racial terror. But what I do understand is that in the future that I want to contribute to, working people from diverse backgrounds and orientations understand that we have more in common. You see? So the ultimate revolutionary practice is a practice in which people are unified against a common oppressor and can identify social conditions as coming from a set of root causes that benefit the few at the expense of the masses. And that violence, often interpersonal violence in our communities, stems from the economic reality that shapes our political ideological orientation.
And I would say, first of all, thank you for your genius. I love it when you break it down. And also, there is a way in which we come back to that idea of do I belong, because there's a... when we are in scarcity, and that leads to a victim mentality, and it's hard for us, it's easy for me to go into my own pain and who did what to me without seeing what I, like, what my role is. And I know that, so I participated in the WTO. I was up in Seattle with a large group of people, and it took me maybe several months to come to an understanding that I could no longer attend protests without having a full-on panic attack. Mm. I went so far as to develop an alternative identity as Marge the KBOO volunteer, and I would wear maxi dresses and a long wig and big sunglasses, and I talked in a weird Midwestern accent. And that is how I functioned. I even did an interview with some radio. They were like, who are you? I was like, hey, I'm Marge the KBOO volunteer. Yes, I just work the desk. Yeah, I'm out here fighting fascism. You know, like, and that, if I could not be who I was. And so one of the things that happened was my community was so used to me being a decision maker. When we were up at the WTO, I was part of a group of 50 people with the Amalgamated Everlasting Union Chorus. And we were running after fascists while singing Phil Oaks. And I was helping, I was just holding a space of like making decisions. And then after that, I kind of couldn't do that anymore. And my community kind of got angry with me. And none of us could see that I was in trouble. None of us could see that it was happening because I had been harmed by this event that we had all gone through. And I was just having a very extreme reaction that was touching into some of childhood stuff that I had not recognized yet. So then it became, I needed to do a big withdrawal from my community in order to, and it became like very isolating and insulating. And it was like, Mo is having a problem. So having a framework of understanding around, like, I'm a big fan at this age of the debrief, of like you have a thing and then at least some people get together and go, okay, what just happened? What worked? What didn't work? Or work, and how can we move forward? And I struggle to have that happen, and I don't see it happening a lot. And I personally, if I could go back and help my young self, I would say learn about the debrief. And and learn how to ask for help and identify injury in each other, you know, because when you are young and you're in a group and you don't have mentorship, which is was my experience, you also don't really have support outside of yourself. And so when there's a problem, it's just on the individual.
It's on you. It's on you.
Yeah. And that's not, I don't want to say that story in a way of blaming. And so to be able to participate in this project and to be able to pour all of that passion that I still have that can't flower on the streets really anymore has been a real gift to me. And I just thank all of you and Aaron and Alec and Julie Perini for.
Yes, the rest of the team. Yeah.
And you can come see us at Powell's.
That's right.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
So I often hear, you mentioned wanting your family to listen to the podcast, but they didn't want to be depressed at the content. I've heard that so many times.
It's weird.
So many people have said, I started it, but I haven't. It's just like really heavy. I never saw it that way. I'm wondering what you all think. I saw it as like a lot about community and what's possible and information on how we can proceed now. So what do you all think about that?
Jonathan here. For me, it was a and remains a constant process of going back, skipping forward from the general to the specific and then back again. So the information in the book is rare. It's been curated with great care. The narratives are remarkable. And, you know, reading and absorbing it can be difficult because it's, well, I mean, it opens with a vicious, racist murder that cannot be avoided. It cannot be, you know, just speaking about it is, you know, horrifying. So there's that. But I think it's, you know, we have to find ways to relate that time period, the community defense, the, you know, meetings, all the organizing to today, because that threat remains and has become sharper and much larger.
Yeah.
I mean, much larger. There is, I mean, I sometimes kind of sit back and try and develop a comprehensive and compelling explanation of how we got from there to here. What has changed? And what do we do? So I think this is one of the important documents that can help us answer those questions. But, you know, we have to at least start asking that. And we have to recognize the threat of fascism, of the far right, of white nationalism. And unfortunately, there are folks, even within our broad radical family, even within the broad socialist, anarchist, communist, whatever community, who refuse to acknowledge that the threat remains. And we have to clean up our own house. We have to get our own house in order. And that debate, which is not for now to, you know, it's, we don't want to do that now, but it has to take place. And I don't think it has. Because if it has, then we wouldn't be doing some of the things we're doing today in order to confront the far right. And so I'll leave it at that.
I wanted to just add, you know, around this question of violence that, and this is something that John Baer has pointed out, the state has a monopoly on violence. You know, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the FBI, the CIA, you know, what some people call the alphabet boys or whatever. These state agencies have a means to get away with murder, right? And then because we live in white supremacy and they can legally murder us, and they do daily, it's still happening here. Malcolm X Grassroots, you know, put out this study that said that every 28 hours somebody black was being murdered in America by the police or by somebody self-deputized. You know, the mentality of George Zimmerman, who murdered Trayvon Martin. Yeah. The stand your ground laws that have really been created for white landowners to get away with murder in the name of protecting private property. The way that T-Rex was murdered in the park, and in Normandale Park in Portland, and identified the shooter, the mass shooter, as a property owner before they you know what I'm saying? So these things are things that are still happening. And it is harsh, it is traumatic to be aware of this reality, but this reality is part of our lived everyday reality in our city, not in some far distant place. Mm-hmm. And so being aware of it, talking about it, creating a story and about how this has impacted us as a community and in collective work together is just part of, I think, the social responsibility of people. It's part, if we don't tell these stories, no one's going to do it for us. The corporate media, the commercial media that's profit-centered, that wants to appeal to the lowest common denominator with sensational, that feeds us violence every day is entertainment. Yeah. Come on now. Yeah. It's easier for people to be entertained by high-speed chases and buildings exploding than it is to pay attention to the Hollywood depiction of war and graphic violence as entertainment, and that's okay. But when we talk about what's really happening, it bums people out.
It's depressing.
Come on now.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and it's extra, I mean, my family was influenced by the Berrigans, one of the Berrigans' famous nonviolent thoughts.
Daniel Berrigan.
Berrigan was Jesuits, my mother's right? professor, yep. you know, and she just, but it's also part of the brutality of capitalism when you live under it and you have to provide care for family members that should be shared in a burden with everyone, you know. Anyway.
And bless all our families.
Bless
and
them all.
And this isn't about, like, you know, punching down on folks who don't want to be further traumatized. That's not what it's about. No. Yeah.
Thank you all for that.
Well, that was an amazing conversation. Is there anything else that you would like to add? Again, remind people of the event on June 6th.
June 6th at Powell's, 7:00 p.m. And obviously it's all ages. If you want to reach out to do an event with us, you can write us at itdidhappenherepodcast@gmail.com. keep up with our events at our Instagram, It Did Happen Here Podcast, or at itdidhappenherepodcast.com.
And you can get the book at PM Press.
You can get the book at PM Press. You can buy it at Powell's. We'll be tabling around town. We'll table your event, perhaps.
Yep.
Co-published with Working Class Histories.
That's right.
Thank you so much. This was so enlightening and stimulating and totally inspiring. Do you have any last words to, again, you guys were talking about young people and the tendency that people have to be entertained and to kind of get lost in fiction and not pay attention to the reality. Any words to, like, let's say, young people that are, you know, they just follow the typical tendencies in our culture, just entertainment and not reality. What would you tell them? Like, hey, this is important because this and this.
Create your own media. Create your own art. Create means of expressing yourself that make it entertaining to entertain reality.
Learn history.
Fight fascism. Win the revolution. Remember, you got to do both.
Unite to fight. And remember that your connection is the way. You're connected to the earth. You're part of everything.
And support KBOO.
That's wonderful. You've been listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Special program is here for the Public Affairs Department. It Did Happen Here, a very important podcast, book, and project. Thank you so much for your attention.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.